Imagine a justice system built on rigorous evidence, not gut instincts or educated guesses about what works and what doesn't. More people could access the civil justice they deserve. The criminal justice system could be smaller, more effective, and more humane. The Access to Justice Lab here at Harvard Law School is producing that needed evidence, and this podcast is about the challenge of transforming law into an evidence-based field. I'm your host, Jim Greiner, and this is Proof Over Precedent.
Here we are with the Proof Over Precedent podcast. I am your host, Michelle Blue, and I'm a communications specialist at the Access to Justice Lab. I don't have a background in law, but I'm here with Jim Greiner. Jim, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, Michelle. I'm Jim Greiner. I am a professor at Harvard Law School since 2007, and I am the faculty director of the Access to Justice Lab.
So why have we teamed up to produce a podcast that you should listen to?
I think we want to try to get the word out about bringing credible evidence to lawyers and judges and decision makers in the legal field. The ultimate goal of the Access to Justice Lab, which we'll talk about, is to transform the legal profession into an evidence-based field from its current state. Its current state is where the only real sources of truth in terms of what works are what the cool people say is true, so what elites say is true, and then what day-to-day experiences are for lawyers and judges. And we at the Access to Justice Lab want to bring a third way of some scientific measurement, some counting, some empirical evidence, and to generate the evidence and then allow policymakers, meaning judges, lawyers, court administrators, everyone who makes up the legal profession, to be able to use that evidence. And this is an additional format that we can use to try to get the word out.
So, Jim, you're with the Access to Justice Lab. Can you tell us about what that is and how and why it was created?
Yep. So the Access to Justice Lab is a research entity within Harvard Law School. It has about 8 total employees and founded in 2016 with a starter grant from Arnold Ventures, what actually then it was called the Laura and John Arnold Foundation. And it, again, purpose was to try to transform or begin a movement to transform law into an evidence-based field.
What do you define as access to justice?
Usually when people hear the phrase access to justice, they think entirely civil. They think solely things like family law or housing or government benefits. Those are sort of traditional things that legal services providers, legal aid providers have focused on. Maybe some additional things like debt collection, defense, or perhaps folks that are a little bit more adventurous might look at things like litigation finance and regulation of folks who would like to offer what we now call legal services or legal information, but some of which can't offer those because they're actually not lawyers, they're not JDs. And we think all of that's important, and we want to study all of that. But one of the things that we don't like about the definition, the traditional definition, is that it excludes the criminal justice system. Again, people say access to justice, they usually mean access to civil justice. And we think the dividing line between the civil justice system and the criminal justice system is 100% artificial. What we want to talk about at the lab is how do human beings interact with the formal legal system? And so that means a lot of criminal work because there's an awful lot of interaction that occurs over on the criminal side. And so that means that we at the lab like to do projects on bail, on prosecutorial practices, on first appearance hearings generally, on even at the beginning of the legal process, on the arrest, at the back end of it, at the trial level with sentencing and with the conduct of trials, and then even farther back. We have projects that we'll talk about at some point on the podcast about criminal justice record clearing, which is a process that often occurs years or in some instances decades after the end of a criminal case. So we just think that's all important and it should be included in the topic of access to justice.
Back to the podcast, it's called Proof Over Precedent. That emphasizes the role and need for evidence over historical reference and legal decision making. So what can listeners expect from the podcast? Let's talk about some of the topics you want to talk about.
Yeah. So I think there are going to be a lot of topics and a lot of speakers. And so we want to introduce variety on both of them. With respect to the topics, as I mentioned, it will cut across the civil criminal division. And so listeners can expect to hear things about the criminal system from its initiation with an arrest until the end, which might be criminal justice record clearing, it might be reentry from a prison system. But the common link is going to be some reference or some involvement of the formal legal system. And by formal legal system, I mean that we will typically not be focusing on things like alternatives to the legal system in the sense of consulting elders within a community or consulting religious figures within a community, unless what we're studying is whether that's a more effective dispute resolution system than the formal legal system. We might do that, but we would not take on a project that just says, hey, what if you went to a religious leader or a community organizer or something to try to resolve a dispute? That would be a little bit beyond what we know how to do. And then in terms of some of the topics, I made a list here of, gosh, I don't know, it goes from A to J. I guess that's kind of, I didn't do that on purpose, I just realized. It goes from letter A to letter J is what I mean here. But, and we may not go through all of them here, but we want to talk about important and interesting findings and research papers from the Access to Justice Lab, but equally from other researchers in the field. And so I'm anticipating that we'll ask some folks to appear as guest speakers on the blog and talk about findings from a recent paper or from a paper that actually isn't all that recent, but we think deserves some additional attention. We've ongoing projects at the lab of interest and ongoing projects of other Access to Justice researchers, again, on both of the civil and the criminal side. We've got what people can learn if they do suppress the distinction between civil and criminal cases. And I think there are some lawyers that practice, some practitioners that practice both types of law. And I think we'd like to get their perspective. One thing, for example, that I think we could all learn from ignoring this distinction is in the criminal justice system, I think everybody pretty much acknowledges that we practice a whole lot of what's on the civil side we call limited service representation. And as soon as you label something limited service representation, there's a whole lot of literature and there's a whole lot of learning that comes from that. But on this criminal side, they've resisted labeling what they do as limited service representation. And I think that's a mistake because it demonstrates that there are some pretty severe limits to the way that we implement the right that came from Gideon versus Wainwright on the criminal side. We want to talk about why we focus on randomized control trials, and that's the first time that we've mentioned the RCT in this episode. But at the Access to Justice Lab, we focus almost entirely on RCTs, doing RCTs in the field, and we can talk some more about that. We want to talk about why we do that. We'll have some podcast episodes on that. One of the things that supports our focus on RCTs is in other fields, what I like to call professional reversals. So examples of instances in which the professionals in a particular field have all gained or built a consensus around a particular practice. This is a good idea. And then somebody does an RCT, a randomized study, and finds out that it's either a terrible idea, that it backfires entirely, or that it's no better than a less expensive and less intrusive practice. Lots of those examples from the medical profession, things like hormone replacement therapy, Vioxx, a certain kind of stent in arteries, for example, was a multi-billion dollar practice over years, turns out to not be particularly effective. Not that all stents are bad, but stents in certain situations are not effective. And then from non-medical fields, we have things like scared straight, from criminology. There are other examples that we want to dedicate episodes to. We wanted to talk about regulation of the legal profession itself with the unauthorized practice of law rules and the litigation finance rules, both of which inhibit access to justice. We shouldn't go too far without mentioning artificial intelligence. Everything is AI these days, and the AI perhaps has potentially the most potent power to upset, disrupt the current legal profession. Enormous potential to promote access to justice if done well and done correctly. Here's a topic that I never thought I would be thinking about, which is ethics. It turns out that when you randomize people out in the field, there are enormous ethical issues. And so for those of you listeners who know what an IRB is, an Institutional Review Board, we have one at Harvard, and those folks have become best friends. I have them on speed dial. We have lunch a couple times a year, right? Because everything that we do involves research ethics, and I've had to learn some of the history of research ethics and some of the reasons why there are institutional review boards. And it turns out that the federal regulations that are applied to our field operations are incoherent when applied outside the medical context. They are just completely make no sense, and we're conducting research on that as well. And then finally, my favorite of all, we're going to have some student podcasts and student blog entries, because every podcast that we do will be accompanied by a blog entry for folks that like to read as opposed to listen. And the students in a seminar that I'm teaching have already recorded several podcast episodes. And we've only had one round of these, but the topics are fantastic. The topics are all over the place, everything from what criminal interrogation rooms should look like to court practices of banning cell phones inside the court, and how that causes people taken by surprise by the cell phone ban who show up to court for the first time maybe and don't know about the cell phone ban to have to bury their cell phones in the soil outside the gardens outside the court, and how thieves have figured that out. They dig the cell phones up and steal them. And various ways in which rules like that, just, you know, what you can bring into a courthouse inhibits access to justice.
Just a quick question about the student topics. How do they come up with these topics? Are these ones that the lab has already addressed, or the students have come up with them on their own?
I mostly turn them loose. I've given them lists of topics and papers, mostly by other scholars, that they could use. And some students have chosen to do that already. I mean, again, it's only the first round, but some students have chosen, for example, to focus on a paper that someone else has written. It'll be a blog post and a podcast about the gender of Gideon, for example, about how the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court's weighing of interests emphasized physical liberty over things like a relationship with a child, or adequate housing, or financial security in the sense of minimal financial security, not, you know, long term, but just minimal. Do you have enough to eat? Can you put a roof over your head? And how the folks who suffer from deprivations of physical liberty are 85% male. And the folks who suffer from the other things that I mentioned are 80 to 85% female, and how it's not just a neutral choice. And again, I don't want to steal the student's thunder, but that's an example. And that comes from a paper from a scholar who wrote a paper called The Gender of Gideon. And we're going to, you know, that'll be an example.
I look forward to hearing about all those topics. What about current events? Are you going to be addressing anything going on currently, and where and whether RCTs are things that could apply?
Absolutely. So again, focus is on RCTs and on randomizing some aspect of the formal legal system, or the way in which law offices operate. And some of that might be, hey, there's a new practice, that some new innovation that a judge or a law office is pursuing, and we'd like to evaluate it. We'd like to see whether the practice produces the results that its initiators, the people who conceptualize the practice, what they thought it would produce. And so we're talking about some of those ideas, and that will lead us into current events. Not, you know, what's going on in the White House, but instead what's going on, again, in the formal legal system.
This type of work, is it being done elsewhere that you're aware of?
So there's some excellent work that's adjacent, or that sometimes periodically happens in this area. So there are really fantastic centers in criminal law, for example, the Chicago Crime Lab, the Quattrone Center at Penn, who will occasionally do an RCT. And are studying the area of criminal law more generally. The Chicago Crime Lab, unsurprisingly, focuses a lot on Chicago. Quattrone Center focuses exclusively on criminal justice. There's fantastic work being done in social science more generally, focused on economics at the Jameel Poverty Action Lab at MIT. And that has become so successful that now it's a really large office. I mean, they have entire floors of buildings dedicated entirely to doing randomized studies. There are policy labs, such as the California Policy Lab or the lab in D.C., that will typically do randomized studies focused on a particular area. But to my knowledge, we're the only one focused on the legal profession as a whole, where we do civil and criminal from start to finish. And I like to think that we try to take on projects that other people acknowledge should be done, but for whatever reason don't do, either because they're too long, they're too risky, they're too expensive, or because it's just too difficult to try to recruit field partners. I guess an additional topic I didn't mention was how field operations like this happen. In other words, these are field RCTs. They're not randomization going on in the lab. But again, that can be fantastic work as well. You can learn a ton from the lab, but we don't do that. We do entirely field operations. And so how you put together, what sorts of challenges you encounter in terms of things like obtaining documents that a state agency by law has to provide to you but doesn't want to, or how you run surveys, because we don't do a lot of surveys in the law. But it turns out that perhaps if you've randomized something, such as, for example, a bailout by a charitable bail organization, you probably want to do some surveys to see whether folks who receive the bailout are thriving in ways that folks who are not receiving the bailout are not, because there are certain types of information you can only get from a survey. So we do as well.
Now, off air, Jim, you mentioned your maybe your niche or the thing that you jones when it comes to this type of work. What was it?
It's what I mentioned about doing the kind of work that people acknowledge should be done but don't do. And so for whatever reason, I guess I've never been skydiving or, you know, skateboarding down steep mountains or something like this, but I like a little risk in my professional life. And I think the folks who work at the lab recognize that there are sometimes when you need, it's a good idea to take some risks. And so what that means by risk is you're risking potentially your reputation. Also risks involved in spending, you know, 2 or 3 years constructing, with a fair amount of your time invested, constructing a field operation that then for whatever reason crashes and burns right in the middle. Perhaps because funding gets cut and these field operations are expensive, or because some key player said, no, I don't like this anymore. Or some new, a key supporter of the study left in the middle and is replaced by somebody who can't stand it. And so, you know, that's sort of 2 or 3 years of work that goes poof. And I guess I'm fortunate enough to have had that happen to me 3 or 4 different times. And so I can speak from experience, and other folks at the lab can speak from experience on that.
Then that will be interesting to hear, as well as the successes. So if you're a listener who's interested in hearing about legal risks, then this could be your podcast. But who else are we trying to reach? What's the message we want to share?
Yeah, I think what we'd like to is start a movement that transforms the legal profession into an evidence-based field. And there are a lot of people doing this kind of work. There are a lot of people attempting to produce the evidence. There's a whole movement, a whole conference on empirical legal studies. There's a whole society of empirical legal studies. Some of that is access to justice related. A fair amount of it's not, as you might expect, but some of that is access to justice related. Some of that actually speaks to lawyers and judges and practitioners and court administrators and other people who shape the way that the law interacts with human beings as opposed to institutions. We would like to contribute to the effort to try to say law should be more evidence-based. Its policies should rely on evidence, on proof, not on the way things have been done for decades and decades, not on what we call precedent. By precedent, we mean not a legal ruling that then should be copied, but rather the way in which the legal profession has done things for a long time and therefore continues to do them just because we did them that way for a long time, not because there was any evidence-based reason to do them that way.
Is there anything else that you'd like the listeners to know about?
We are excited to receive ideas about what we should cover in the podcast and in the blog. What would people like to hear about? I hope to be interviewing researchers that do both quantitative work and qualitative work, because we think the qualitative work has been fantastic and illuminating. There's a lot that just deserves to be elevated. And so we hope to, you know, contribute to the process of elevating some of the qualitative findings. And again, all these different topics, everything that we mentioned before, we'd love to hear from listeners on, you know, who should we interview? What topics do people want to cover? What are some recent innovations that deserve some attention? And what could be questions about those innovations? What are age-old questions that people have had in this field? A good portion of our podcast will take the form of somebody at the lab interviewing somebody from the field, a practitioner, a judge, a scientist, someone like that. So who would you like to hear from?
Proof Over Precedent is a production of the Access to Justice Lab at Harvard Law School. Views expressed in student podcasts are not necessarily those of the A to J Lab. Thanks for listening. If we piqued your interest, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Even better, leave us a rating or share an episode with a friend or on social media. Here's a sneak preview of what we'll bring you next week.
We have this prior scholarship, lots of it, that would tell us that an expert, you know, decider does not necessarily have their ability to judge credibility or judge based on demeanor cues, either remote or in person, is really just random chance. And so maybe putting all our eggs in that basket is not the right decision.